Our next presentation is a double header, very important presentation on the essential role of the laboratory. There'll be two presenters, Dr. Kathleen Taddy and Dr. Bill Bellini. Dr. Taddy will go first. Dr. Taddy is a research biologist working on molecular diagnostics in the pertussis and diphtheria lab at CDC. She designed a multi-target PCR assay for the diagnosis of pertussis, which has been introduced into several state public health labs for routine use. And Dr. Bellini will follow immediately after. He's the chief of the measles, mumps, rubella, and herpes viruses lab branch at CDC. Dr. Taddy.
Good afternoon. I will discuss the essential role of the laboratory in vaccine program surveillance for bacterial vaccine preventable diseases, VPDs, illustrated here from left to right, Haemophilus influenza, Neisseria meningitidis, Streptococcus pneumoniae, and Bordetella pertussis. Specifically, I will focus on Streptococcus pneumoniae and Bordetella pertussis as examples. Laboratory confirmation is critical for all bacterial diseases because pathogens cause similar clinical syndromes that can only be distinguished by laboratory testing. If someone has pneumonia, meningitis, or sepsis, several bacteria can cause these symptoms. Moreover, one pathogen can have multiple serotypes or serogroups which have different epidemiology or prevention measures depending on the particular serotype or serogroup. For example, the meningococcal vaccine protects against serogroup A, C, W135, and Y, but not serogroup B. Determining the antimicrobial resistance of the pathogen is important in treating the disease. Monitoring the molecular characteristics of the pathogens is needed to control and prevent further future disease. The active bacterial core surveillance is an active laboratory and population-based surveillance system for invasive bacterial pathogens of public health importance. With the implementation of vaccines, disease incidence declines and clinical diagnosis is less specific, which makes laboratory confirmation more important. Thus, it becomes critical to determine serogroups, serotypes, or genotypes. An accurate diagnosis is required for timely intervention in outbreaks, is essential for routine surveillance and control of these infections, is necessary for improving vaccines and vaccination programs to measure the vaccine impact, its effectiveness, developing the best vaccine policy, and refining that strategy. The surveillance and lab work performed on Streptococcus pneumoniae is an example where the vaccine was modified based on such laboratory surveillance data. Accurate diagnosis may also be a diagnostic challenge because real cases may be outnumbered or masked by lookalikes. The work performed on Bordetella pertussis is an example of this situation. So now let's look more closely at the VPDs which have new vaccines available, for example, Neisseria meningitidis and Streptococcus pneumoniae. Surveillance is needed to monitor disease, changes in serotypes and genotypes, and determining the vaccine effectiveness. The data obtained allows for improved future diagnostics and vaccines. The data is shared through the ABCs and NVSN. The laboratory work on these particular bacteria is moving towards molecular diagnostics due to the decrease in cost, quick turnaround time, familiarity of techniques, and widely available reagents. For Streptococcus pneumoniae, it is necessary to perform serotyping of the isolates in order to guide vaccine development, evaluation, and policy. It helps determine whether the vaccine may be useful in controlling outbreaks, but is rarely useful clinically. Serotyping that is PCR-based is less expensive than the classic approach and is more practical for evaluation of state-based immunization programs. The website to obtain more information is listed here. Public health laboratories were trained in serotyping of Streptococcus pneumoniae at CDC during the ERA project. How has surveillance of Streptococcus pneumoniae isolates by PCR-based serotyping helped? CDC laboratories monitored the emergence of a strain of antibiotic-resistant pneumococcus, serotype 19A, that was not covered by the first pneumococcal conjugate vaccine, PCV7, and this helped to guide the inclusion of this strain in the newer PCV13. How has PCV13 impacted disease in children less than 2 years? This graph on the slide demonstrates the early impact of PCV13 use on disease in children less than 2 years. On the y-axis is the number of cases per 100,000, and time is on the x-axis. You can see that from October to December in 2010, in white with a star, in January to March for 2011, once again in white with a star, and compare those values to the baseline from 2006 to 2008 in yellow in these time periods, that the number of cases has decreased. Thus, PCV13 has helped to reduce disease in children less than 2 years of age. Now let's talk about the strategies taken for a bacterium that is ineffectively controlled by vaccination, Bordetella pertussis. To better control this disease, we need improved laboratory diagnostics to determine the real burden of disease. We need to evaluate commercial diagnostics and kits. Standardized testing methods will help to better understand the results, allow more consistent interpretation, and improve diagnosis. Discussion among public health labs regarding current testing methods, in-house assays, interpretation criteria, and cutoff values will aid in better diagnostics. It is essential to confirm the clinical diagnosis of Bordetella pertussis in order to distinguish it from diseases with similar clinical presentation. Although culture is the gold standard and very specific, it lacks sensitivity, while serology is used late in the course of illness. Thus, PCR is widely used early in the course of the disease and has increased sensitivity over culture. A multi-target PCR approach has been developed at CDC, and several state public health labs have been trained on this assay. The reason that this multi-target PCR approach was developed is that many clinical, commercial, and public health labs were using only a single target assay, which is not specific and does not allow speciation from other Bordetellas. The multi-target PCR approach allows speciation. False positive PCR results have been obtained, and pseudo-outbreaks attributed to Bordetella pertussis have occurred, such as a hospital outbreak in 2006 and a community outbreak in Colorado in 2009. Now, what are the reasons for false positive PCR results in these outbreaks? Possible explanations for false positive results are summarized in this slide. Use of only the IS41 assay for diagnosis can cause false positive results, as many times high CT values are not real. Or the positive IS41 could be a different species, such as Bordetella holmesii, and is misdiagnosed as Bordetella pertussis. Recently, we have seen this situation in Ohio. The community outbreak in Colorado in 2009, with many high CT values for IS41, was due to environmental contamination, most probably from the B. pertussis DNA present in some vaccines. This was confirmed by environmental sampling of clinics, demonstrating that there was contamination of clinical specimens during the collection process. In order to help clinicians, a best practices guidance containing suggestions to aid in improving PCR practices was developed in response to recent pseudo-outbreaks and false positive PCR results. Basically, we included ways to optimize the PCR results in order to avoid contamination of clinical specimens with B. pertussis DNA and to interpret PCR results properly. This figure on the slide illustrates how, by implementing our PCR interpretation criteria on the results during the Colorado outbreak, we identified the problem. On the y-axis is the CT value for B. pertussis, and on the x-axis is time. In the spring, on the right hand, the PCR results were either indeterminate with CT values greater than or equal to 35 but less than 40, or negative with CT values greater than 40. Further analysis demonstrated that all these specimens in that springtime came from the same clinic and were not real but false positive. In the winter months, on the left hand side, it was most probably a real pertussis outbreak. The website for the guidance is listed at the bottom of the slide. As workers in the field of public health, you know that what you do is important. Surveillance, epidemiology, laboratory confirmation, and prevention and control measures must all be used together to correctly identify and control disease. I'd like to thank Nancy Messonnier, Lucia Tondela, Shima Mandel, Leonard Mayer, Cynthia Whitney, Bernard Beal, the Meningitis and Vaccine Preventable Disease Branch, and the Respiratory Disease Branch. Thank you.
And now we'll hear from on the essential role of the laboratory from Dr. Bellini. Thank you.
Good afternoon. The role of the laboratory in viral disease surveillance has changed significantly over the last decade. Most of the changes have come about as a result of the success of vaccination programs and the decreased prevalence of diseases. Over the next few minutes, I would like to highlight some of the changes and associated challenges that have occurred and inform you of some of the steps that the laboratory has taken to solve some of these issues where possible. As you can see, the basic elements of surveillance haven't changed by necessity, but some of the assays and tools that are implemented have changed. Measles has been eliminated for about 12 years from the U.S., and most cases can be traced to imported sources. But for sporadic cases of measles, confirmatory laboratory diagnosis can be challenging. The IgM assay has historically been and still is the major confirmational tool used by the laboratory. Under the best of circumstances, the IgM really can't be called positive until 4 days, or convincingly positive until 4 days post rash onset in unvaccinated individuals. Some previously vaccinated individuals don't mount an IgM response and present with modified disease that may not look like measles. We also know that from our experience now with molecular assays that real-time RT-PCR assays are more sensitive than serology early on in infection. This slide depicts the performance of commercially available IgM assays, and as you can see, it's quite variable. This slide compares the performance of 6 available IgM assay kits relative to the CDC measles IgM capture assay. The 2 kits on the far right are the 2 most commonly purchased in the U.S. and have acceptable performance characteristics overall. However, the other kits are sold and are used by some labs in the U.S. The CDC and APHL work together to do this analysis and are making these data available publicly in a manuscript form. Now, the actual molecular assays that we're talking about have been developed at CDC, but the CDC can only provide the protocols to the state public health departments. We have done so, and just in 2011 alone, we have sent out protocols to 30 laboratories. We've also sent out test panels for validation of these laboratories, and 22 have been returned, and all have passed. This slide reflects the increased testing in both the capture IgM and in-house testing using the molecular assays in 2011 as a result of the increased measles activity. There were 222 cases last year. This in part was responsible for the increased interest in the molecular assays expressed by the state public health departments. This next slide points out one of the most crucial surveillance activities that the lab is involved in, and that is molecular surveillance. This depicts the numerous sources of importations up to the middle of October of last year. imported cases and associated outbreaks accounted for about 50% of all cases last year. This slide depicts then the major challenges for measles case classification and diagnosis and elimination settings. The take-home message here is to please collect the viral specimens and serologic specimens at first contact and don't wait, because there are instances whenever follow-up that testing must be done immediately at first encounter with the patient. And the individuals that you may actually encounter may have either primary or secondary vaccine failure, and that case investigations are very important and lab testing must be done immediately. The challenges with rubella are much the same as they are with measles, except that there are even fewer cases of rubella, and about one-third of them can be asymptomatic. The same issues exist for the IgM false positive testing, and in some cases these false positives crop up in pregnant women, where the real issues with regard to CRS or congenital rubella syndrome are very apparent. This is why the rubella laboratory has developed additional and sometimes redundant testing to help rule out the possibility of CRS. Although there were only two or three case outbreaks of rubella between 2004 and 2011, and 76 total cases from 58 different countries, the CDC on average manages to perform between 100 and 200 rubella tests of some type each year on submitted specimens. And one can see the various types of testing available, an overall increase in the molecular assays in the last few years. The reason that the molecular testing has increased is essentially the same as in measles, and that is actually observed in this chart, where it can be seen that, you know, near the time of rash onset, that throat swabs are positive actually by PCR. If you look at the molecular assays, which sort of in the center of the chart, versus the IgM, which is the last in the last portion of the chart, can actually be used as detection. You don't see the IgM be positive until about 3 days or so post rash onset, where the molecular assays are actually can detect virus anywhere from about 4 or 5 days before rash onset and continue on through to about 4 or 5 days after. Maximum rubella cases are confirmed with the combination results of both types of testing, but the specimens must be collected, and that's the whole issue here. You have to collect both specimens. Molecular epidemiology and surveillance is crucial for the maintenance of rubella CRS elimination in the U.S., just as it is with measles. Molecular epidemiology and surveillance is crucial, and there are 13 genotypes distributed into two clades for rubella. This slide simply depicts the importations of rubella into the U.S. from 2007 to 2011, and although relative to measles, there are fewer importations, the surveillance system appears to be intact, and that we have not missed any large rubella outbreaks, and U.S. endemic CRS cases are non-existent. Mumps has presented one of the greatest challenges. For reasons that remain relatively unclear, large outbreaks of mumps have occurred among previously vaccinated individuals, even with two doses of vaccine. Although mumps is considered controlled, we have had two major outbreaks, the most recent among Orthodox Jewish communities in the Northeast in 2009 and 2010. Most of the available IgM tests, are not performing wonderfully in vaccinated populations. As a matter of fact, as you can see, in vaccinated populations, most of the indirect assays detect only 15 to 20% of the cases, where the capture does a little better and it detects up to about 30%. Most vaccinated case patients fail to make an IgM response and have resident IgG from the first time you see the patient. Traditional immunologic correlates of protection, such as neutralizing antibody, do not appear to apply well to mumps. And finally, there's no evidence for genetic escape mutants to explain any sort of immune selection or to explain these infections in previously vaccinated individuals. This slide shows a comparison of real-time RT-PCR using two targets, the N and the SH, or two genes in the virus, and an in-house mumps capture IgM test using serum and throat swab specimens collected in varying times post-peritonitis onset, up to about 5 days. As you can see, the real-time RT-PCR assays using the N gene as target was superior to the SH gene target, and both were better than the IgM detection early in disease. The PCR using the N gene as target detected about 85% of cases after 1 day post-peritonitis onset, while only 40% of these cases were detected by the IgM capture assay. Now, this is an in-house capture assay at CDC. The percentages were reversed then at day 5 post-peritonitis onset. Commercial assays compared in the same analysis did very poorly, and this data is not shown in this graph. These are general recommendations for laboratory testing for mumps, and essentially what this boils down to is that if you're going to do assays, if you're going to do mumps assays, molecular assays are superior. You should actually do them on well-described cases with peritonitis, and basically we do need both serologic and virologic specimens to collect for both serology and genotyping purposes. The National VZV Laboratory has been in existence since 1998, and essentially the take-home message from VZV Laboratory studies so far is that their success has been widely acclaimed for their work in the vaccine status, looking at vaccine studies, excuse me. They have been also involved in nomenclature and formed the basis of the molecular epidemiology of varicella and developed the real-time PCR assays, which is primarily to rule out smallpox. Now, the challenge here for the VZV laboratory is, again, very much like mumps, is our breakthrough infections. The vaccine is about 85 or so percent or 90% efficacious. It may be in the sort of low 90s. And you have breakthrough infections usually present as milder disease with fewer lesions, and it's easily missed. So you have IgM serology is of little value and quite variable. When PCR is currently the test of choice using lesions as specimens. And as I said, the greatest challenge is the development of more sensitive assays to detect infections in vaccinated populations. I think what I'll do is simply go, if you want more information on the testing of these viral vaccine preventable diseases, there are two websites that are listed in the bottom. And I'd like to thank the following individuals: Carol Hickman, Jill Eisnagel, Jennifer Rota, Paul Rota, and Scott Schmidt for their slides and for discussion for this talk. Thank you very much.